Blog Talk Radio.
Reading a little something there at the beginning of the show, so sorry for the long intro. A very good old friend gave me a little ping on Facebook, and I didn't want to ignore it. Welcome to Eerie House. I am your host, Crazy Dale K from Spook Show. And what a wild and crazy summer it's been. Most notably, last weekend, had a little fun at Monster Fest Mania. So finally, Northeast Ohio's got a classic horror and sci-fi show. It was a lot of fun. Got to hook up with some old friends, make a few new ones, and had a very good time, especially in part to one of our listeners, Space Pirate, today, our live listeners in the chat. Thank you for that wonderful, wonderful backdrop. And also Matt Skelly, who orchestrated a really, really nice live spook show for the movie House on Haunted Hill. And even his own children got in the act with running the props and did a little puppetry and character playing. So that was a lot of fun. If you've never been to a live spook show, you've got to see one. And hopefully there'll be some coming to the Ohio area. More about that later on. Our topic tonight is kind of a favorite of mine. I think I've pretty well documented myself as being a huge, huge fan of special effects animator Ray Harryhausen. The guy is just one of my heroes. But there's another, my second favorite, that we want to talk about today, and his name is Jim Danforth, who probably was also a Harryhausen fan. In fact, I'm positive of it. Some of his work, very, very similar. I would say if you're any kind of a horror, sci-fi, fantasy film buff, I'm trying to think of a movie that you'd know and recognize his work with. When Dinosaurs Ruled the Earth from 1970 would probably be most notable. But before we're done today, you're going to be surprised at some of the projects, films, and television shows that Jim Danforth has done work on. In addition to being an animator, Jim Danforth was a matte artist as well. What is a matte artist? Well, and a good definition from Wise Geek tells us that a matte artist is a filmmaking professional who develops mats, which are scenes that are used to create background textures and images. If I were to put it simply, it's the stuff you see behind green screen that makes a background, like it puts you in a set that maybe it's not affordable or practical to go to, such as another planet or an exotic location. That's an oversimplification of what a matte artist does. It's part of the compositing process. And what I mean by that, folks, is when you're putting a piece of film together, there's several pieces that are put in place to make a scene work. So Jim Danforth, not only an animator, but a very accomplished matte artist. Early in his career, he started out working as a sculptor and an artist for clay animation with Art Clokey. Now, if that name rings a bell, Art Clokey had worked on the Gumby series during the 50s, and later on, Jim Danforth got his first job working with him. Shortly thereafter, really, after working with Mr. Clokey, he started working with a company known as Project Unlimited, and worked with a team of effects technicians. It's funny, too, because Danforth has worked on several of my favorite films, and in 1960, he worked on The Time Machine. Now, I don't know if how well-versed my audience is today on the time machine, but there is some animation used in the film. There was an inchworm or a worm and also a growing flower. Those things were animated to show the quick passage of time as the time traveler first started experimenting with his machine. So that was kind of cool. Later on, according to IMDb, Mr. Danforth worked on Master of the World, a great Vincent Price movie. He was a miniature maker for that one. Atlantis, The Lost Continent, also in 61. He did some stop-motion animation there as well. A lot of his early work was uncredited, including a very, very interesting film. If you haven't seen it, you have to. It's called Jack the Giant Killer. And, you know, you could look at that film as a cheap, cheesy remake of The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. The storyline is very comparable to Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, and also some of the actors. Torrin Thatcher, who plays the evil magician in Seventh Voyage, plays an evil magician in Jack the Giant Killer. Kerwin Matthews, the star of Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, playing Sinbad, plays Jack in Jack the Giant Killer. Some of the monsters are even somewhat similar. You know, Harryhausen had the Cyclops. There's a great two-headed giant in Jack the Giant Killer. Pretty neat looking. If you want to check it out, check out some of my Facebook pages. I put up a short video. It was a test piece that Mr. Danforth put together for the making of Jack the Giant Killer. An entertaining film, though. Again, kind of a cheap, cheesy ripoff. You could look at it that way. Or you could look at it as sort of an homage. It's still, all in all, a very enjoyable film, fun to watch. Another not well-known film, at least to me, I've seen it maybe once, maybe twice in my life, was The Wonderful World of the Brothers Grimm. Now, Jim Danforth was a stop-motion animator and a visual technician for that one. And he also worked on A Mad, 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 Mad World. He did some stop motion in that film. It's been a long time since I've seen it, so I can't reference really any particular scenes that he may have worked on. But you can be sure that was a big budget film with all the cameos in it. Certainly not a horror film, but a great comedy film and lots of fun. Another film that I talked about a great deal on radio here is another George Pal great, and it's called The Seven Faces of Dr. Low. I was surprised to learn, really just today while doing research, that he did some, although not overly surprised because there was some animation in it. He did some of that as well as some special visual effects. But equally as surprising yet not surprising, Jim Danforth worked on 24 episodes of The Outer Limits from 63 to 64. And I wasn't overly surprised because I remember in particular the episode called The Xanti Misfits. You know, the ants with the human faces? Well, that was clearly his type of work. He also did some of the monsters in some of the other episodes of Outer Limits, and they're very, very enjoyable to watch. And as you see in more and more of his work, I think it becomes more and more recognizable. Another very low-budget film that was made in 1970 is called Equinox. Now, Danforth was the mad artist, worked on special equipment, special photographic effects, a cell animator, and almost all of his work, again, uncredited. I think the guy truly had a love for his work, especially in When Dinosaurs Ruled the Earth. He did about seven or eight different things for it, most of them uncredited, including mat work, effects cameraman, stop-motion animation, visual effects. The only thing he really was given note of was for special visual effects in that film. Again, you might look at it as a ripoff of 1 million BC. Here's a big surprise, and this one I just found out today. He was a model animator, uncredited once again for the original Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. That's right. He's the guy who made the Wonka Vader come to life and burst through the roof of Willy Wonka's factory. So that was a real shock to find that one out today. There was a piece of work that he truly did not want to be credited on. And it's kind of a little embarrassing, but it's, I guess you'd call it a semi-porn film called Flesh Gordon. Now, he specifically asked to be not credited on that film, possibly because of the nature, the adult nature of the movie. But the makers went ahead and credited him anyway, but they spelled his name backwards. His first name, M-I-J, and his last name spelled backwards as well. So that was kind of an interesting fact to find out today. What would be your favorite film, I wonder? Audience, you've got David Binkley, Evil Annie Repert, and Space Pirate. Thank you so much for listening live. If you want to type into the chat, are there any particular films that you've seen, if you're familiar with his work? If not, you really need to get out there and take a look at it. On a more contemporary basis, he worked on Caveman. You know, the movie with Ringo Starr, the comic dinosaur movie. Very, very good film, lots of laughs. A deliberate spoof of 1 million BC, I think. But I think by this time he was working with more professional staff. The animation was much cleaner and much better. And later that year, that was 1981, he finally got to work as an assistant to Ray Harryhausen. That's right. He worked on Clash of the Titans, predominantly the Flying Pegasus scenes. He did some other work as well, but the most work he did on that film was with the Pegasus. But it must have been a real thrill to work with Ray Harryhausen. Now, Jim Danforth used to be part of the effects nominating committee for the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. And when one of my most hated films, the Dino De Laurentiis King Kong, was awarded an Oscar for Best Visual Effects, that film was never nominated by that committee. And Jim Danforth was rather upset, I understand, and he quit the committee and the Academy in protest. His publicized action was popular with film fans, but disturbed, you know, the Hollywood bigwigs because they want to keep the status quo unchallenged. But I give the guy lots of props for standing up to the man. And, you know, just walking out on him. Sometimes you have to walk out when you don't agree with what's going on. Well, with that being said, I'm going to take a short break and play us some interesting monster movie radio ads and clips from radio ads. I'll be right back in just a few minutes.
The sound you hear is dripping blood. This is the start of Black Sunday.
You are now inside a flying saucer. Our destination, the planet Earth.
What orgasmic ritual unlocked the hidden sexual appetites of these women?
Only you of Earth, you and your women, can give us life.
And what we want, we take.
Dracula!
If they multiply, they could destroy the world.
See the blazing holocaust of an Earth gone mad.
See on the giant screen in flaming color.
You'll scream as fiendish movie monsters actually become alive, then crash right out of the screen, go into the audience, and carry screaming girls from their seats.
Since the beginning of time, man has lived in terror of the unknown creatures that come up from the depths. Sea serpents, sharks, killer whales, jaws of all kinds, lurking in the awful blackness at the bottom of the sea. Now, the most shocking horror of all, a living tidal wave of terror is coming up from the depths.
They began in the water. Dark, gliding shapes that violate every law of nature. They're not human, but they hunt human women. Not for killing, for mating.
The most terrifying picture of our time.
How do you do? Imagine, if you please, a black, moonless night. You're on a street, alone in the darkness. Suddenly, out of the shadows, there is a furtive movement.
Imagine yourself on a dream vacation, sipping Mai Tais, basking in the warm Hawaiian sun, swimming in the tropical ocean, surfing at Waikiki. Your vacation is about to end. Something is coming up from the depths. A monster that rips and tears, hungry for flesh, a ravenous creature human eyes have never seen before. And it's coming up from the depths. Rated R under 17, not admitted without parents.
Turn my microphone back on. Sorry, gang. And that'll teach me to smoke while I'm on the air. I had a little bit of a coughing jag, and I had to step away for a little bit. And while I'm back, it looks like I have a caller from the Northeast Ohio area. I can imagine who it might be. Is it David?
It is. It is.
Hi.
I loved your little radio spots there. That's fantastic.
Oh, thank you. It's David Binkley from Weirdness Really Bad Movie Gang. Welcome to Eerie House.
You know, when I saw your topic, I said, well, I don't know how much I've really paid attention to him before. He's done a ton of stuff.
Yeah.
I've watched I didn't realize.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to talk about him. I don't think his work has been appreciated.
You asked on the Mad World. He portrayed the comedians in small figures as they were running around in some of the scenes.
Ah, well, thanks for checking that out for me, giving us a little more detail. You yourself have mentioned the educational value of shows like this.
What a great movie that was. I mean, you'll never see a cast like that again.
No, oh my gosh, talk about a cast of thousands. That's almost literal in the case of that movie. Even one of my faves, unfortunately not Curly or Shemp, but the Three Stooges were in it as well.
Yeah, as the cameo, that kind of got them back into some of the feature films again. From the cameo on that. That was, I think, Stanley Kramer's first comedy film, and he had no idea when he had pulled all those people together. All those comedians together, what to do with them. Because they just did whatever they wanted.
But it still came off good. It's a well-loved movie.
Absolutely wonderful. You know what? He also, I see he was had work on the uncredited. But uncredited doesn't mean unpaid, right?
Right. They just didn't throw him up on the
his name on there. But he was in the original Star Trek pilot, The Cage, which they later used in the series.
Yeah.
He did some work for, and that, and like you said, I didn't realize he was one of the ones that did On Outer Limits, and they were busy creating special effects for television in that series.
Yes. You'll see a lot of the same usage in both Lost in Space and Star Trek. You can see where some of that was born from those shows, and obviously Mr. Danforth had his impact and his influence on that very genre, absolutely.
Nominated several times for an Academy Award, lost out to Disney, two of them.
Yeah.
Lost
now
out
I
to
learned
Bed
about Mr.
Bedknob and Broomsticks and Mary Poppins. He lost out to those two movies.
Yeah. In the first half of this show, I mentioned a lot of the films that I was kind of, you know, a few things that I didn't, but a lot of the things I was familiar with his work, learning from the horror mags I read as a kid, as a young monster kid. But as I did my research a little bit yesterday and a lot today, the latter half of his career I found astounding, predominantly as a matte artist. I'm sure where animation was needed, he did work, but he was a matte artist for Conan the Barbarian, the remake of The Thing, you know, the one with Kurt Russell.
Right.
Yeah, and even he did some photography effects, but again, as a matte artist in Twilight Zone, the movie from 1983.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise. Well, you remember that one when they redid? There was only one original episode in there. The one with Vic Morrow. The episode he died in.
Yeah.
Was the only original episode. All the other episodes in there was a remake, and the remake of It's a Wonderful Life, Spielberg did. There's a lot of that type of stuff in there.
Yeah.
It's a good life. I'm sorry. It's a good life.
Yeah.
So I can see where he could fit right into there. But, that doesn't surprise me. I didn't see that in the list that I had in front of me. And who hasn't seen... you mentioned it, the caveman. I thought that was great. I thought that was a hilarious film, and his little things I'm sure with dinosaurs crowing and things like that were him.
Yeah, although they credit him as a mad artist, I can't help thinking he had to have a hand in the animation, because in his early career, I think that was his passion. But you know how Hollywood is. You got to take the work they give you too.
And I think another thing you mentioned, how it must have been for him finally to get a work on Ray Harryhausen's film, Ray's last film, Clash of the Titans. Almost, you know, following his footsteps and emulating what he does, and then finally getting to at least work with him one time before Ray Harryhausen, you know, heads off into the sunset. It just had to be...
Sure. And I'm sure for Ray, it was a passing of the torch, because he learned from his mentor, Willis O'Brien, the guy who brought King Kong to life. And he got to work with O'Brien in the original version of Mighty Joe Young in 1945. So I'm sure there had to be something of a passing of the torch. If not acknowledged, I think it turned out that way.
Even though, like you said, he was doing a lot more backgrounds, mat work type thing later on, it seemed.
Well, that, and I think the art itself of stop motion animation started slowly fading away with the advent of CGI and other computer generated effects. the need and the usage, especially in higher budget films, just kind of went away.
Stop action was not only so expensive, but it also was extremely time consuming. The one sketch that Chuck and John did that was stop action took them actually 2 years, and as John would say, about six pair of pants to do. because it took. Yeah, that was part time. It wasn't full time. It was here and there when they could. But, you know, that took 2 years.
Are you talking about the intro where they recreated the King Kong on the building with the planes and stuff?
No, the one where John's driving along on the road with no car, and Chuck's got a motorcycle that he doesn't have a motorcycle with. And it's a short that they did with
like
a local
Golf
guy.
Commercials.
What's that?
Very, very, very much like the old Golf No-Knocks commercials where they scooted
on
their bus.
Yeah, actually very much like that. And I guess Ray Harryhausen actually saw that and declared that one of the best amateur stop actions he'd ever seen.
That's great. What a great acknowledgement.
You could take that one somewhere, yeah.
Now, there's something credited here to Jim Danforth that I have not seen, and now I it's going to be a mad obsession until I see it. In 1985, a documentary piece was made called The Fantasy Film Worlds of George Pal. And
yeah,
as I mentioned,
I haven't heard seen it, though.
No, and as I mentioned, you know, a couple of Danforth's early works were on George Pal Productions, two of my favorite films, The Time Machine and The Seven Faces of Dr. Lowe are indelibly marked in my psyche, so that is a film I definitely want to see. Harryhausen worked with George Pal with these early puppeteons doing fairy tales.
Okay.
Yeah, there's some great stuff from the 40s. I'll talk off online about you because I have some interesting information I'd like to share with you. Not necessarily for the public at this time, I'll spill the beans a little bit. When Erie House TV breaks out, I have some pieces that I'd like to share with everyone. So there.
That's called a teaser, Dale.
Yeah, and you can expect Erie House TV to pop up in maybe just a couple weeks now. I got to put a few things together. And it's going to be fun. We'll have some old-time TV shows, some unhosted movies, and some horror-hosted movies as well. So that'll be fun.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, getting back to Danforth, he also did a couple films that I'm not real big fan of, but, you know, you got to still admire his work. I really never cared for the Never-Ending Story 1 and 2. He did, Matt artist work on those, and... dare I say it, the Ewok Adventure, the TV movie.
So what I want to know is if it's a never-ending story, how come there's a second part?
Yeah. Good question. Good question.
Well.
I don't know. There's some other films that he worked on real quick as we're winding down here. He also worked on Friday the 13th, Part 8, Jason Takes Manhattan, Deep Star 6, the movie Bugsy from 1991, Memoirs of an Invisible Man in 92, Robot Wars in 93, and the last credit they give him on the IMDb is The Prophecy in 1995. I believe he's still with us, but I don't see where he's been really active in the film and television world since 95. So I don't know if he's retired or what happened there, but...
Hopefully he'll call in for the after party.
Yeah, maybe. Well, thank you so much for calling in here. I had a lot of fun sharing with everyone what little I know about Jim Danforth. I do love his work. I remember seeing Equinox. The first time I saw Equinox was on Big Chuck and Houlihan, believe it or not. That was back in the...
Oh.
I want to say the early mid-70s. It was very low budget, so it didn't take long before it was on television. And I've yet to see a good copy of it. I don't know if any exist because the majority of the copies that are out there, it almost
probably
seems like a homemade
bootleg
film.
Yeah, mostly bootleg.
Yeah, a lot of them are scratchy. They're it's like a little washed out, like too bright. But I did find on YouTube, I found a trailer that looked very, very nice, actually. So I'm wondering if there's any good prints of it out there. I don't own a regular store-bought CD of the film. I should probably buy one because I haven't seen it in quite a long time. but the gentleman who played Herb Tarlick was in it. I bet you that was one of his first acting roles. From WKRP?
Yes.
Yeah, he was in that film. Imagine that.
Involved in.
So of all these films, real quick, with about 40, maybe 30 seconds left for the live portion of the show, of all those films, which one would you say is your favorite Jim Danforth film?
It could be Time Machine.
Okay. I have a hard time because, you know, Time Machine, Seven Faces of Dr. Lowe, but I think he did more work on When Dinosaurs Ruled the Earth. If you haven't seen it, David, please do. I want to thank the live listeners, Evil Annie Rapper. Very spacey. That's the original Onions. That one's called Onions in Space. Those guys were so nice to let me use their music, you know, for my horror hosted, you know, the Dale K. Spook Show, and for the different ventures I've worked on over the years, including Eerie House. So that was very kind of them to let me use their stuff, because it's really cool music.
It is really cool music. Good to find those instrumentals that you can work with like that.
Well, yeah, and the feel of them too. They have a little. Some of them have a bounce, like the one I introduced the show with. It's called Onions a Go Go. That's one of my favorite ones that they have. It's jazzy, it's poppy, it moves, and I like it. Yep.
Has a good kind of 60s feel to it.
Yeah. Yeah, and what was it, the week before last, when you called in for the television show, we played their version of One Step Beyond's theme. They entitled it Fear. Now, I thought about that after the show, and it is very cool that they made a version, but it doesn't make you feel as creepy as the television's.
No, because his Adventures did it too, and theirs didn't seem as creepy as the television's either.
No, that slow violin was just very, very eerie. And like you, I found that scary as a kid.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Especially when all the stories are based on, in truth, events that actually happened.
Yep.
Supposedly.
I love stop-motion animation, and I want to dabble in it some more. Someday I'd like to have some of the Standard 8 and Super 8 films I made as a kid converted to video and just put a little string of them together for fun. I would take Lionel train sets and have them attack and those. I remember having a hard time with I had a Tyrannosaurus I made of with clay, modeling clay, and I ended up using rice for his teeth. I'd stick little pieces of rice in his mouth. And that was fun. You still with us, Dave? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm still here. It just, I never had that kind of equipment or my dad had an old 8mm, but I didn't really have that or really any kind of cam work. I did have a small reel-to-reel. I played with that a lot.
Oh, yeah. Well, that shows because I know you have a penchant for audio. I was lucky as a kid. From the time I was 13, I always had to have a job because I always wanted money for my hobbies, be it collecting comic books, horror mags, and shooting film and putting film together. I really never thought of myself as the acting type. I much rather would have done special effects or production work or something like that had my life taken a different path. But anyway, I could hop the bus and go to Southgate or some of the stores that were near Southgate. Now, that's a shopping area near the border of Maple Heights and Bedford Heights. I grew up in Bedford Heights. Well, I didn't grow up. I got older. But I would go to these camera stores, and they'd have these cheapy bins, you know, the brand new stuff I couldn't afford with what little money a young kid could make, you know, as a caddy or working at McDonald's or whatever. A couple summers I was a lifeguard, but I'd go into their cheapy bin, and they'd have these 8mm cameras, and I would always pick through them and find the ones that had single frame capability. And then, of course, I had to get a tripod to hold the camera steady.
Right.
And, that my first experiments were doing the golf no-knocks thing with the neighbor kids, you know, having them scoot down the driveway as if they're in a car, and then animating chess games. And then the first thing I tried to do with any kind of animation, I made a tentacle, just one, tentacle with a T, with two T's, out of
Glad you clarified that. This is a family show.
Well, I took some, like, a big aquarium rock and, you know, some aquarium plastic plants, and I made the tentacle emerge from behind the rock and, like, pick up matchbox cars. And that was my first attempt at it. And that came, the more I did, the more I wanted to do. So like a couple years after I got started toying with that, I found out our high school had a very small rear projection screen. Now the fun began. How do I make my animated clay dinosaurs mix in with live actors? And I made a brontosaurus-type character, but being the impatient type I've always been, I decided to make a new unknown dinosaur that only had two legs. It was like a brontosaurus that had that was maybe disabled. He only had two front legs and no back legs, and it just gave me less things to animate. And
so,
I had one.
So you go back to Ray Harryhausen. That's your inspiration for what you were doing as a young teen?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Ray Harryhausen, I credit with really jump-starting. I mean, I always loved the monster movies as a kid, but he really got me going. I have to say it was probably Jason and the Argonauts. Seeing those skeletons, I remember thinking to myself, there is no way that's a guy in a suit. You know, I kind of saw myself as something of a sci-fi highbrow because the movies from the 50s and the early 60s, quite frankly, the special effects were not believable. They just weren't that good. And, you know, having a lot of the, and I'm probably going to tick off some of my friends and associates in the horror and horror host industries, but I just was never really a big fan of Godzilla. The guy in the suit thing really bothered me. So when I saw Harryhausen's work in Jason and the Argonauts, you know, in particular the skeletons, but the other characters in the film as well, I thought, how is he doing this? How is this done? And that's what inspired me to start buying Famous Monsters of Filmland. There were a couple, I think it was issues 117 and 118 around that time.
Okay.
I had bought a few issues before that, but I saw that there were two back-to-back that were dedicated to him, and that's when I started learning all about stop-motion animation. And so I'd get this rear projection screen, and I'd have a projector set up, the camera set up, pointed at it, and I put together just a short scene of myself looking at my kitchen table. I must have been about 13, 14 at the time, and I'm reaching tentatively towards this miniature dinosaur on my kitchen table snapping at me. And I would take those to school for special projects and whatever, or, you know, I'd try to always work my hobbies into any, you know, homework that the teachers would give you in particular classes and find a way to link it to whatever the topic of the class was. And the kids at school were just amazed at what I had done. And that was such a rewarding feeling because then they would ask me, how did you do that? You know? And, of course, I didn't want to tell them because that's the fun.
Big fan of the stop action. Do you dislike CGI? And I have a friend who actually hates CGI. Are you a fan of CGI?
I have mixed feelings about it because when it's done well, it's really, really good. There are parts of the Jurassic Park series that I really, really love, and there's parts of it that I'm not so enamored with. The thing I did like about The Lost World is they mixed practical effects with the CGI. For example, the scene where the sick dinosaur, and they had a giant bladder in it breathing in and out. It reminded me of what Willis O'Brien had done in his original Lost World. He put bladders inside his animated models to make them breathe. And add more life to them. So that was a big, giant, you know, practical effect, and it was very realistic looking. I have mixed feelings. In the Peter Jackson King Kong, I thought it was overkill. They did too much CGI.
Yeah. The problem I have with remakes is they don't make the story better. They just have better CGI or better special effects.
Mm-hmm.
They're not improving on the story. They're not necessarily, and they're probably not improving on the acting because you've got all the CGI. Not that it's not difficult to act with something that isn't there. I would imagine that would be tough. But still, the actors who were originally doing these before there was the CGI, and limited special effects. You relied more on the story and the script and the actors. And
that's my problem with films today in general. That any kind of, especially anything with any kind of action, be it sci-fi or be it just a police drama or whatever, it seems to me the movie sells the action so much. See, in spite of my love for these things, I learned very early on that less is more. I learned that as a DJ using light effects when I had the good fortune to work somewhere that had really good light effects. I found that less is the most dramatic effects you want to use the least, because if you keep giving them the best you have, it loses its impact, and that's true of films too, I think. And yeah. It seems to me that today's filmmakers are in such a rush to get to the action, to get to the special effects. First of all, they overdo it, and they don't leave time for character development, for story development. And I think that's what you and I are seeing.
Yeah, yes, yeah. Exactly.
But, yeah, it has to be very difficult to react to something that isn't there. I read at one point Kerwin Matthews, while making The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, you know, that was very challenging for him to duel a skeleton that wasn't there.
Yeah, I'd imagine so.
There's a few small flaws. There's one scene where he spins around and the skeleton actually moves into his field of view. you really don't notice it when it's played at regular speed, but if you play it back at slow speed, which of course everybody wants to do now today, that's the other thing is
right.
Everybody feels they're an expert on special effects and they pick these things apart, and that's overdoing it too in a way, because you got to lose yourself in the movie to some degree, you know what I mean, without picking up, I saw a flaw, well, you're not really enjoying the film then.
Yeah, you're spending your time looking to see where you might find a mistake. So the film must not be very good if you're doing that, you'd think. But yeah, that's kind of a waste of time. Enjoy the movie. Sometimes you have to watch it a couple times. Once you watch it for the movie, then you start watching it for other things. I know when I watch, I kind of watch movies a lot of times for the acting and for sometimes, what I call a really interesting line. And then you can watch it later and catch some of the other things. And a lot of movies you really don't get to see until you watch them three times.
I just shared with a friend of mine maybe it was my kids. I don't know. I had a conversation very recently. Also had the good fortune of working at Randall Park Mall when it was a brand new mall in the mid-70s. Near the Maple Heights and Bedford Heights areas on the southeast suburbs of Cleveland. And I knew someone who worked at the theater, so needless to say, I would get in a lot for free. And I saw the original Star Wars from 1977. I must have seen that at least 20 or 30 times in the theater. It wasn't a family member, because now I recall parts of the discussion ran to how many different versions of the same film were released. There were differences in small lines that I would notice. I had seen it so many times that I almost memorized the thing. And the first time I'd watch it, I watched it was simply to sit back and enjoy. But then I would start looking at, all right, how did they do this effect? How did they make this work? And like you, how did that line work? What led up to it that made it funny?
And
that's half the joy of it.
Absolutely.
Life didn't take me that way, but sometimes I felt I was destined to be a filmmaker because I was, not in any formal sense, but I was something of a student of horror and science fiction films.
But with what you do here and when you do your show, that you certainly show your appreciation for the films.
Well, yeah, that, and I want to share my love of it, and again, what limited knowledge I have of these things. I've been blessed at different times in my life to be around people who know a great deal more than me, who are equally willing, and sometimes in a greater sense, willing to share their love for the genre and their knowledge. They're going to kick us off here shortly here on Blog Talk Radio, so for those of you listening in the archive, thank you very much, and most of all, David, thank you for being supportive and calling in today and sharing.
It was fun.
It always is. You're you're a good guy who also has a love for film in general. So always a pleasure to have you here. You know the door at Erie House is always open. And for everyone else,
you do need to oil it up a little bit.